Hello and welcome to the 2009 Turning Sight into Sound Christmas Special. I'm Laura Upton. In this year's Christmas Special, we answer those lifelong questions we've always had about Christmas traditions from a book titled Christmas Miscellany, Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Christmas by Jonathan Green. Some of your favorite volunteer readers will join me in reading selected stories. And Scott Arthur will take us on a trip down memory lane from the 1920s to the 1960s with Christmas Memories, Gifts, Activities, Fads, and Fancies by Susan Wagoner. The Christmas that we celebrate today is a creation of the past as much as it is a thing of the present. The customs that we keep are an amalgamation of the practices of other times, cultures, religions, and countries. Such diverse groups as the Romans, the Vikings, the peoples of medieval Europe, and the Victorians, and such faraway places as Germany, Holland, and the Middle East, have all had as big an impact on the creation and evolution of Christmas as have the birth of the baby Jesus, the Bible, and the Holy Land. Indeed, many of the Christmas customs we keep today have their origins thousands of years before Jesus Christ was even born, when people worshiped the Son as the giver of life. And yet, most of us keep these customs without knowing or even wondering why. Why do we put up Christmas trees, send Christmas cards, stuff ourselves with turkey, and hang up stockings on Christmas Eve? You might answer by saying that it's traditional or simply because it's Christmas. But how have these traditions come about in the first place? And then, there are the fascinating facts about Christmas that have been forgotten in this modern age. Did you know that the first Christmas lights used to adorn a tree belonged to Thomas Edison? Or that Santa Claus's official post office is in Finland? In our first Christmas story, we ask the question that every child has asked their parents. Where does the Christmas tree come from? It would be hard to imagine Christmas without the familiar conical form of the festive tree. From December onward, if not before, they can be found everywhere, from homes and schools to department stores and pretty much anywhere people will spend any amount of time during the Christmas period, whether it be a hospital or an office. But where does the tradition come from? And has it always been such an important part of the Christmas celebrations as we now know them? Well, in some ways, it is one of the more recently established Christmas traditions, with the decorated tree as we know it rising to popularity during Queen Victoria's reign. And then in other ways, the tradition is older than Christmas itself. At its root, it's really just another example of an evergreen brought into the home during the cold, dark days of winter by our pagan forebears, along with the Yule log, boughs of holly, and mistletoe. But it was actually the Romans who got there first, as they did with so much of that which has become modern-day Christmas tradition. During the festival of Saturnalia, held in honor of Saturn, the god of agriculture, ancient Romans decorated trees with small pieces of metal. The first Christmas trees were decorated with apples as a symbol of man's fall in the Garden of Eden when Adam and Eve ate of the fruit of the tree of knowledge. As a result, they were called paradise trees. In time, other decorations were added in the form of nuts and even red ribbons or strips of paper. Ultimately, the apples were replaced by Christmas baubles. In the Middle Ages, the paradise tree went up on the feast day dedicated to Adam and Eve, December 24th, and to this day, purists believe that you should wait until Christmas Eve to erect your own tree and then take it down again on the 12th night. Possibly the earliest depiction of a Christmas tree dates from 1521 and comes from Germany. The painting shows a procession of musicians accompanying a horse-riding holy man, who may be a bishop or even Saint Nicholas, parading through a town. One of the men in the procession is holding high a tree decorated with what look like apples. A candle-lit fir was also erected in a London street in the 15th century, but such trees remained as outside decorations, and there are no records from the time stating that they were ever taken into the home. Evergreens in other forms were also used to decorate houses, though it is quite possible that some homes also included a tree rather than simply being adorned with bits of one. However, according to some historians, the first recorded mention of an actual Christmas tree appears in a diary from Strasbourg dated 1605. This particular tree was decorated with paper roses, apples, sweets, and gold foil, the first tinsel. In the church's attempts to Christianize what was essentially a pagan practice, the Christmas fir had Christian symbolism foisted upon it. Since to look at it, its shape was essentially triangular, the three points of the triangle were said to represent the Holy Trinity, God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit. To add weight to the argument that putting up a tree in your house during the winter months was their idea, Christians in the Middle Ages also perpetuated the legend of Saint Boniface, which predated Germanic diary references to Christmas trees by several hundred years. Boniface was a monk and schoolmaster from Devon, living in the 7th and 8th centuries, but the event that connects him with the origins of Christmas tree occurred at Geismar in Germany. He was there carrying out missionary work, preaching the gospel, at the behest of Pope Gregory II. The story goes that Boniface came upon a group of pagans worshiping a sacred oak tree. The Druids were preparing to sacrifice a baby to their bloodthirsty pagan gods when Saint Boniface came to the infant's rescue. Incensed, he grabbed the axe that was going to be used to end the baby's life and instead laid into the tree, furiously chopping it down. With the babe safe in his arms, he saw that from the roots of the felled oak, a fir tree was growing. To his holy eyes, the fir was a symbol of Christ's resurrection, with new life growing out of what had been a tree of death. Sometimes this story is linked to a different saint, the 7th century Wilfrid of York. In this version, the saint set out to cut down an oak tree, which was the focus of a Druidic cult. As he chopped it down, the oak split and a fir tree grew from its heart. Wilfrid dedicated the fir to Christ, declaring that the evergreen represented the eternal life offered by the Savior. And then again, 16th century folklore states that it was Martin Luther, the German theologian, who was the first person to bring a decorated tree into the home. After walking through a starlit forest of evergreens, Martin felt inspired. Bringing a tree into his own home and illuminating it with candles, he reminded his family that Jesus Christ himself had descended from heaven to die for our sins. However, there are some historians who claim that there is no evidence of a lighted tree until more than a century after Martin Luther's death in 1546. It is the commonly held belief that it was Prince Albert, consort of Queen Victoria, who first brought a tree, in this case ordered from Coburg in Germany, into the home, in this case Windsor Castle, at Christmas time. However, although it may be true that the tree he had set up for his family in 1841 set the trend for such trees, after the royal family were depicted gathered around the royal Christmas tree in the London Illustrated News of 1848, this wasn't the first time Windsor Castle had had a tree. Queen Charlotte, the German consort of King George III and Victoria's grandmother, had ordered a Christmas tree, or Weihnachtsbaum, for the Queen's Lodge at Windsor in 1800, and trees became a permanent fixture there for a number of years afterwards. The practice had been a common one in Germany before the royal family popularized it in this country. Probably the most famous Christmas tree in England is the one given to the city of Westminster by the people of Oslo in Norway. It is a gift given in gratitude for the help Norway received from England during the Second World War when it was occupied by enemy forces. King Haakon of Norway was able to escape to England and set up the Free Norwegian Government. Every year since 1947, the Norwegian tree has been put on display in Trafalgar Square in London. At approximately 70 feet tall, it is the only unmilled tree over 12 feet that is allowed to be imported into the country. There grows within the grounds of Glastonbury Abbey in Somerset an altogether different kind of Christmas tree. It is a bush of the variety Crataegus monogyna biflora, a cultivar of the common hawthorn that flowers twice a year, better known as the Glastonbury thorn. According to legend, after the death of Christ, Joseph of Arimathea, who gave his tomb for Jesus' body to be interred within, visited England with the intention of spreading the gospel. While he was visiting the west of England, he lay down to rest, but not before thrusting his staff into the ground. When he awoke again, he discovered that his staff had miraculously taken root and come into flower. From that day, the Glastonbury thorn has continued to flower on Wirial Hill every Christmas, a sign of the hope that the birth of the infant Jesus brought to mankind. However, during the 17th century and the Puritans' attempted purge of Christmas in all its forms, the original Glastonbury thorn was uprooted and destroyed. Fortunately, people had been taking cuttings from the holy hawthorn for years, and so the tree lived on. It was one of these cuttings that was planted and subsequently thrived within the ruins of Glastonbury Abbey, attracting countless visitors over the years. Just like the Glastonbury thorn, Christmas trees don't have to be fir trees. In the past, trees such as cherry and common hawthorns have been used, while in India, Christians decorate banana trees at Christmas time. So now, the Christmas tree is a part of almost everyone's festive season, whether it be real or fake, with piles of presents beneath and adorned with all manner of decorations, some of them of the edible variety. Here's Pearl Hewitt with Did You Know?
Did you know the first decorative electric lights used to embellish a Christmas tree were those displayed in the home of one of the vice presidents of Thomas A. Edison's electric company in the 1880s? By 1909, you could buy light bulbs in the shape of Santa or a snowman, although the now familiar flame-shaped bulbs did not appear until the 1920s. Most households, however, couldn't actually afford to buy fairy lights until after the Second World War.
Scott Arthur joins us now and takes us on a trip down memory lane with Christmas memories of the 1920s.
The 1920s, Jazz Age Jubilee. Was there ever a decade in America that couldn't be described as a red-hot firecracker of a time? But the 1920s really lived up to that billing. And during that decade, Christmas, like everything else in America, began to shimmy and shake. Store windows sparkled and sometimes sang. Bright lights glittered on once humbled main streets. Some thought the excess signaled the end of the world, and others saw it as nothing more than a big, booming canvas of America itself. Over the top didn't exist as a phrase back in the 1920s, but if it had, it would have aptly described Christmas trees of the era. Unlike later decades, which favored a pyramid-type tree tapering off to a single point at the top, the 20s demanded girth. The bigger around the middle, the better the tree was. And if a tree grower could have cultivated a perfectly spherical tree, well, he would have made a fortune. Getting the desired girth often meant buying a tree much taller than the ceiling allowed, a tree that remained too tall even when the bottom branches were trimmed away. So the enterprising homeowner tackled the problem from the top. Pictures from the era showed trees lopped off where they meet the ceiling or the uppermost tips bent back. Although tree lights had existed for some time, few families actually had them. For one thing, lights required electricity, something only about half of the population in America had. And even those who had electricity often found the lights too expensive. A string of colored Christmas tree lights in the early 1920s cost $3.50, which would be about $40 today. Yet even without lights, trees glittered. Tinsel, previously made of expensive silver, was now affordably mass-produced from inexpensive lead. Lametta garlands with short, spiky strands bristling from the central wire were especially popular and came in shades of silver and gold. Glass ornaments also added sparkle, though most trees, especially those of the early 20s, had fewer of them than trees of today typically did. Early ornaments had been expensive, with only one or two purchased by a family each year. Back in the 1880s, Woolworths began importing less expensive glass ornaments from Germany. But the idea of a tree laden with balls had yet to take root. Such a tree would have struck many a bit dull, since vying for space with glass ornaments were elaborate decorations made of paper. Heavyweight, embossed, artistically detailed, and printed in rich colors, these conveyed the sense of dizzying abundance that the era prized. If you examine a photo of a tree from this period, you'll see fascinating and multi-layered mosaics, paper ornaments knew no color scheme or season. Nor was it uncommon to see seraphim mingling with crosses and lucky horseshoes and flowers and flags and lady liberties and harps and high button shoes and fans and gloves and other motifs. Now, the finishing touch of the 20s tree wasn't a star on top, as is popular today, but what sat beneath the lowest boughs. Although tree stands were available, they were not particularly stable and lacked water reserves. So many homeowners made their own arrangements. One of the fads of the time was to build a tiered box, insert the base of the tree in it, drape the box with fabric, and create a miniature village and landscape in the snowy folds of material. Poring over old photos, we've spotted flocks of sheep and trains and trolleys and boats sailing beneath the arched bridges, menageries of zebras and lions, or ox carts and nativities flanked by camels and palms, and picket-fenced homes with lace curtains visible at the windows. One can only imagine the delight of children from whom these tiny worlds came alive for a few weeks every year.
Sandy Havens joins us and reads a story about the age-old question, why are carols sung at Christmas time?
Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas. Here we come a-caroling among the leaves so green.
Carol singing, as we would recognize it, dates back to at least the 13th century in England, although we might not recognize many of the actual carols from that time. The idea of caroling is now inextricably tied to Christmas, but it should be remembered that carols have been written for many other festivals that occur throughout the year. A song does not even have to have any religious relevance for it to be called a carol. The word carol comes from the Greek chorus, meaning a dance, via the Latin chorallua and the French carole, which was specifically a ring dance. The English spelling of carol is first seen in the Cursor Mundi, dating from about 1300. In this context, a carol was described as a ring dance in which the dancers themselves sing the governing music. It is hard to pin down exactly what a carol is beyond the connection to dancing, although this itself does not really apply to many carols anymore, as the word has been used to refer to such widely varying pieces of music, from ones connected to the Nativity to jovial drinking songs. Although most would now agree that a carol is a Christmas song with connections either to the religious side or the pagan aspects of the midwinter festival. At one time, such forms of music were condemned by the church. The earliest known hymn in honor of the Nativity is Jesus Refulsit Omnium, meaning Jesus, Light of All the Nations. It was written by St. Hilary of Poitiers, who died in AD 368. Nativity hymns such as this were solemn affairs and strictly religious. Something more like the carols we know today developed in Italy among the followers of St. Francis of Assisi. Having spent much of his youth as a troubadour, Francis decided that the best way to teach people about Jesus Christ was through song. Francis and the community of friars he founded set about writing what many considered to be the first true Christmas carols. Some of them were performed around a nativity scene that St. Francis set up on one Christmas Eve. In 1224, Franciscans brought the carols to England and began to compose new ones in English. The earliest surviving such carol we have written at that time is A Child is Born Among His Men. In 13th century England, carols were sung in respectful imitation of the angels, who, according to the gospel writers, sang Gloria in Excelsis Deo at Christ's birth. At that time, these religious songs were sung only by the priests and choristers in church. However, the lyrical content of some of the carols often incorporated older pagan customs. One such example is the Boar's Head Carol. Others are those about the holly and the ivy, with all their pagan symbolism intact. The carol also developed hand in hand with the mystery play. The Coventry Carol was itself written for one such play, special to the city of Coventry. Some carols were effectively sung narrative poems, such as the Cherry Tree Carol, while others interspersed the ballad structure with lines of Latin that all regular churchgoers would recognize, even if they didn't actually understand what they meant, as in Dulce Jubilo. This style is commonplace in many early 16th century carols. The earliest printed collection of carols was produced by William Caxton's apprentice and eventual successor, Wynkyn de Worde, in 1521. Richard Keele's Christmas Carols Newly Imprinted appeared in 1550, but this particular collection already suffered from the moralizing influence of the growing Puritan movement. During the 16th and 17th centuries, the Puritans made it their mission to take much of the fun out of the festive repertoire. They saw the Christian festival of Christmas as having been corrupted by the more immoral secular celebrations associated with the season. And they were successful for a while, too. As a result, the Puritans did much to put a stop to the singing of carols for a good few years. This temporary suppression of the carol was partly as a result of its association with dancing. Where worship out of doors had been perfectly acceptable in the past, the Puritans restrained their worship to the meeting house. Likewise, there was no movement allowed within church services. Even processions conducted as part of the Sunday service had been removed. The Puritans also had it in for the mystery plays, for which many of the earlier carols had been written. They did not consider it appropriate to reenact such holy scenes as Christ's birth, and so in 1642 an order for the stage plays to cease was passed. Songs that suffered as a consequence included the 15th century Salutation Carol and even earlier Angelus Ad Virginum, which dated from the middle of the 13th century. Many carols contained the relics of a more superstitious age, such as the holly and the ivy, which the Puritans could not tolerate. Only material from the scriptures was considered suitable to be used in songs of worship, so out went such legendary carols as The Carnal and the Crane and King Herod and the Cock. However, under Puritan rule, the carol did not vanish altogether. As long as the songs were holy and somber affairs, sung with all due reverence, they were acceptable. 1642 saw a collection called Good and True, Fresh and New Christmas Carols, published, while, after the Restoration, other collections such as New Carols for This Merry Time of Christmas, 1661, and New Christmas Carols, 1662, followed. By writing their own carols, although they were not what the medieval merrymakers would have called a carol, the Puritans hoped to convert people to their way of thinking. Nevertheless, many of the carols written at this time are no longer in use today, and with good reason. The majority of them were intended to correct people and improve their lives. Such penitential pieces did not prove very popular. One that has endured, however, is the lullaby Wither's Rocking Hymn, written by staunch Puritan George Wither, 1558-1667. Although Christmas carols did not enjoy a massive revival after the restoration of the monarchy in 1660, at the turn of the 18th century, new carols were being written. While Shepherd's Watch and Hark the Herald Angels Sing are both from this time. It could be argued that these were not really Christmas carols, but Christmas hymns, as were what came after, since the music was no longer suggestive of dancing. Whereas I Saw Three Ships, which dates from the Middle Ages, has a galloping rhythm that would have suited a ring dance very well. It wasn't until the mid-19th century, though, that the carol, along with the rest of Christmas, enjoyed a more substantial revival. And yet even then, at the beginning, it was mainly thanks to two men in particular. The Reverend John Mason Neal was warden of Saxville College East Grinstead in Sussex and a known translator of Greek and Latin hymns. The Reverend Thomas Helmore was vice principal of St. Mark's College, Chelsea, and an accomplished musician. These two clergymen worked together on translating and interpreting the 16th century tunes found inside what was possibly the only surviving copy of an ancient book called the Piae Cantiones, compiled by one Theodoricius Petrus of Nyland, Finland, in 1582. In 1553, Neal and Helmore published the fruits of their labors in a collection of 12 carols under the title Carols for Christmastide. The carol, Unto Us a Boy is Born, has been passed on to us from this collection, although it can also be found in a 15th century manuscript, as has Good King Wenceslas. Seeing the success of Neal and Helmore's work and the passion with which it was received, others soon followed in their footsteps, bringing out their own carol collections. Many of those sung today were written at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th. See Amid the Winter's Snow, Once in Royal David's City, In the Bleak Midwinter, and even Away in a Manger were all written at this time. Carol singing itself enjoyed a revival during the Victorian era. The long-lasting impact of the Puritans on Christmas meant that carols were not really sung in church again until the 1880s. It was then that the familiar service of nine lessons and carols was drawn up by the Bishop of Touro, E.W. Benson, who later went on to become Archbishop of Canterbury. New carols are still being written today, of course, along with endless festive pop ditties, but it is the carols of the late 19th century and those that have made it to us from the 16th century that are sung every Christmas with the greatest fondness and fervor.
May God send you a happy, He will send you a happy New Year.
Did you know the name Bethlehem, as in the carol O Little Town of Bethlehem, and Jesus' birthplace, is an Arabic word meaning house of bread?
Here's Scott Arthur again with Christmas memories of the 1930s.
The 1930s, the best of times in the worst of times. It was by all accounts one of the bleakest decades in American history. You'd think Christmas would be canceled, wouldn't you? But it wasn't. Instead, people seemed to enjoy it all the more for the hard times they endured. The Yuletide spirit burned bright, even if the gifts were poor and the plates less full. In fact, some of the very traditions we think of today as emblems of the big, rosy, plush-lined modern Christmas got their start in the hardest of times.
Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind.
People did not stop sending cards during the Depression or even revert to the less expensive Christmas postcard. Instead, the postcard continued to fade from the scene and soon vanished altogether, while cards grew more imaginative than ever before. To be sure, there were many who have sent homemade cards or written letters on a new product on the market, stationery decorated with Christmas motifs and themes. But purchase cards remain the most common way of saying Merry Christmas, especially in an era when phone calls to those even a few miles away could be expensive long-distance affairs. Cards of the era embraced a broad range of motifs. English country themes were still pretty popular, though the colors were now bolder and brighter. The Art Deco influence, still in evidence early in the decade, was gradually replaced by a more realistic style. Many cards reflected the longing for a happy, secure world, glamorous women shopping and putting up wreaths as if they had never heard the word depression.
Little bluebirds fly beyond the rainbow. Why, oh, why can't I?
Jim Seitz joins us and reads a story about another very important question. Why do people put up Christmas decorations?
People have always festooned their homes with some manner of decorations, whether boughs of winter greenery or with enough electric lights to double their energy bills for the year. But where did it all start? Our Norse ancestors used evergreens, mainly holly, ivy, mistletoe, and the branches of fir trees, to decorate their homes during the winter months, and to remind people that life would return to the world again. In time, other man-made decorations, such as bows of red ribbon and lit candles, would be added to enhance what nature had already provided. With the growth of towns and cities by the late 19th century, it was not so easy for some people to simply take a stroll through the nearest stretch of woodland to collect their winter greenery. And so it was that commercialism played its hand. Someone had to bring to market for the urban masses what had once been free to all. This is the case now, of course, more than ever before. Much of the mistletoe that goes into decorating our homes at Christmas time, for example, is actually harvested from apple orchards in France. Following the example set by Queen Victoria and Prince Albert in the 1840s, the trend of having a Christmas tree in the home grew during the 19th century, and so the demand increased to have things to put on it. Other than lit candles of one form or another, at first many Christmas tree decorations were of an edible nature. There were sweets, fruit, and even wafers. Then came small presents and paper ornaments. By the 1880s, glass ornaments were all the rage, with baubles replacing the once traditional apples hung on the old-fashioned paradise tree, a precursor to the modern Christmas tree. A reminder of the forbidden fruit tasted by Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. So now we have strings of fairy lights, tinsel by the yard, and all manner of decorations with which to adorn our homes. Then there is the belief that it is unlucky to leave Christmas decorations up after Twelfth Night. But why should this be the case? Druidic beliefs held that wood spirits were in the evergreens brought into the home, and that they would cause mischief in the household. However, they were prevented from doing so during the period lasting from Christmas Eve to Twelfth Night. After that, they were free to do their worst again.
Did you know, before the advent of fairy lights, many people lit up their Christmas trees with lighted candles? However, for most people, beeswax candles were beyond their budget. As a cheaper alternative, they burned tallow candles. These were made from animal fat, and so would have added a distinct aroma all of their own and a good deal of smoke to the festive home.
Here's Scott Arthur once again with Christmas memories of the 1940s.
The 1940s, war and peace. For all intents and purposes, 1939 was the last Christmas of peace. A military draft was instigated in 1940, leaving many families separated over the holidays. The next year brought Pearl Harbor, and for the next 4 years, Christmas was a time of bittersweet longing. There were only a few questions that really mattered. Is he safe? Is he coming home? When? Peace had never been so much on people's minds, and when it came, the joy and splendor of Christmas burned brighter than ever. Candles in windows were a pretty popular theme in the 1940s. You could see them on Christmas cards, but also in the windows of countless houses across the country. In addition to their coziness and cheer, the candles sent an unspoken wartime message as well. We expect your safe return. Now, the candles weren't real, of course, but electric, made of the hard plastic that was being used in more and more items that had once been made of now scarce metal. Many of the plastic candles also sported transparent plastic halos, edged with glitter, and remained very popular after the war. The new hard plastic was put to other holiday uses as well. There were Santas, sleighs, reindeer, and bells, so hard and durable they actually seemed to chime when clanked together. Even cookie cutters were made of plastic instead of the traditional tin, and came in holiday colors of red and, less often, green. After the war especially, there was a particular fad for tablecloth churches, molded of white or cream plastic with a light bulb inside to shine from the windows. The churches came in varying degrees of elaborateness. Another material used to brighten wartime homes was colored cellophane. Garlands of ruffled cellophane began to festoon mantels and doorways, as did cellophane molded into the shape of bells and bows. The most common decoration was the cellophane wreath, hung on doors or in windows in shades of red and coral or green or plain or bearing an electrical candle. These small circles of brightness were the stand-in of choice when real greenery was scarce. Another item in scant supply during the war was Santa himself, as most Santas had been drafted by Uncle Sam. Competition for large, deep-throated men to ring bells and listen to children's wishes was fierce, igniting Santa wars among rival stores and putting a strain on bell-ringing charities. In 1939, the Volunteers of America had 15 Santas on the streets of Manhattan. The next year, a lone Santa was stationed in front of Gimbel's. And he was no volunteer either. He had taken the job on the promise of $2 a day and a 25-cent lunch allowance, which is equivalent to about $30 a day and about $4 for lunch. Rather than disappoint children, many department stores hired women to fill the void.
On Sunday, December 4th, Burl Ives again tells the exciting news story of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer on the General Electric Fantasy Hour.
Did you know the Red-Nosed Reindeer was named Rudolph after Robert L. May's 4-year-old daughter, Barbara, said that she favored that particular moniker over Rollo or Reginald? The childlike character of Rudolph, who ensured that all the good little boys and girls received their presents from Santa one foggy Christmas Eve, struck a chord and survived, so ensuring that Rudolph became as much of a part of Christmas as roast turkey and Christmas pudding.
Well, now that Pearl Hewitt has told us how Rudolph got his name, Pearl returns with the full story of why are reindeer so associated with Christmas?
You know, Dasher and Dancer and Prancer and Vixen, Comet and Cupid and Donner and Blitzen, but do you recall the most famous reindeer of all?
It may surprise you to learn that reindeer did not enter the Father Christmas story until the 19th century. And it was all the fault of the American Episcopalian minister, Clement Clark Moore. It was Moore who composed the famous poem, An Account of a Visit from St. Nicholas, also known as 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, as a Christmas treat for his own children. In this poem, Moore had a diminutive elf-like Santa pulled in a miniature sleigh by equally tiny reindeer. At one point, Santa reels off their now so familiar names, but which were new to those reading the poem when it first appeared in print back in 1823. More rapid than eagles his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name. Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen, on Comet, on Cupid, on Donner and Blitzen. Moore was embarrassed by his poem, which was wholly secular and mentions nothing of the religious festival that inspired it, beyond the name of St. Nicholas. At first, he didn't take credit for it. However, by the 1830s, it had really taken off, with children all over America expectantly awaiting a visit from Santa Claus on Christmas Eve as a result of his poem. Moore eventually decided it was time to come clean. In 1837, he claimed authorship when it was published in a book of poems, and it appeared in an anthology of his own work in 1844. What is immediately apparent from a reading of an account of a visit from St. Nicholas is the complete lack of an appearance by the red-nosed reindeer himself, Rudolph. That's because he wasn't an invention of Moore, but appeared more than 100 years later. Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer first graced the page in 1939. It was a rather whimsical narrative poem written with the express intention of drawing more customers into Montgomery Ward's stores, and was the creation of Robert L. May, an American copywriter working for the department store chain. The eponymous reindeer subsequently appeared in an advertisement for the Chicago store. Many people know of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer in the form of a song, but it wasn't set to music until 1949. The composer was called Johnny Marks, and his musical version was recorded by the singing cowboy Gene Autry, a big deal at the time. The song has been recorded by hundreds of other artists since then and has sold more than 80 million records worldwide.
Rudolph, Rudolph, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Let's take another trip down memory lane as Scott Arthur tells us about Christmas memories of the 1950s.
The 1950s, home for the holidays. After two tumultuous and painful decades, America was ready to make good on the promises it had made to itself during the hard years of war and depression. Happy days finally were here again, and there was no place most people would rather be than home for Christmas, especially when these homes started echoing with the pitter-patter of tiny feet and the call of small, cheerful voices wondering what Santa had brought. The cost of Christmas in the 1950s. Inflation was generally mild during the 1950s, and what there was more than made up for by rising wages. Let's just thumb through the 1950s catalog, shall we? An artificial tree with fireproof boughs, $5.95. Be about $44 today. Sirloin steak per pound, 89 cents. It's $7.10 or so today. Lamb chops, 75 cents a pound. Compare that to about $6 a pound today. Ooh, Whitman samplers, a one-pound box, which would be about $8 today, was $2.25 back in the 50s. Nestle's chocolate chip morsels, a six-ounce bag, was 19 cents. These days, it's about $1.50. Men's calfskin shoes back in the 50s were anywhere from $9.98 to $17.98. These days, it's anywhere from about $80 to maybe $140. A men's dress shirt back in the 50s was $2.89, as opposed to about $21 today. A woman's wool coat with mink trim, woohoo, $79 to $139 back in the 50s. Today, $600 to maybe $1,100. Women's dress shoes, $7.99 to $18.95. Today, those shoes would cost $61 to about $143. An RCA 21-inch black and white TV, no color here, just black and white, $99. And you were lucky if you had a family that had one. Today, that would cost you, just black and white, about $800. Sears Craftsman 2.5 horsepower lawnmower, $66 to $89. These days would be about $500 to $600. A barbecue grill with legs, $7.80 to about maybe $12. These days it would cost, probably around $60 or $70. An 8mm movie camera and light bar. Do you remember that? About $55. These days, roughly that same type of setup would cost over $400. An 8mm movie projector and screen, $75. Can you just picture all of this? About $600 today. A Mickey Mouse lunchbox was 88 cents back in the 50s. Today it'd be over $7 or probably more for a collector. Children's cowboy boots, and all the kids wore cowboy boots, anywhere from $5 to $8. These days it'd be over $40. Girls' tap shoes back in the 50s were $3. These days about $27. Ooh, and a cootie game. Remember the cootie game? $2. These days about $16. A deluxe senior chemistry set. I had that. Almost blew up my room, but I had that. It cost my parents $11.25. These days would be over $100. Robert the Robot was $5.98. Danger, danger. These days it cost about $48. And finally, a satellite launcher with rotating radar tracking station was $4.98. These days, that little glimpse in the future would cost you about $38.
David Gilmore joins us for our final story and a question that has always been asked through the years, but we don't know if there has been a definitive answer. What are the 12 days of Christmas?
On the first day of Christmas, my true love sent to me a partridge in a pear tree.
It's one of the most popular Christmas carols, telling of a zealous suitor's extravagant Christmas gifts to his sweetheart. But when do the actual 12 days of Christmas fall, and what is the true meaning of the carol's bizarre shopping list? Well, let's start with the 12 days of Christmas themselves. Many people have come to believe that the 12 days of Christmas are those leading up to the main event on December 25th. However, they are actually the days that come after it, with the last day being Epiphany, the day on which the Christian church celebrates the visit of the Magi to the Christ child, and that falls on January 6th. This is why that date is also known as Twelfth Night. This period of time has come to be known as both Twelvetide and Christmastide. In medieval England, it was a time of continuous feasting and merrymaking. There was always plenty of food to go around, or at least there was plenty of meat to go around, as most animals were slaughtered come the winter to save the farmers the cost of having to feed them during the long winter months. But what of the carol? There's a widely perpetuated myth that the 12 days of Christmas was one of the so-called catechism songs. The theory goes that during the period of 1558 to 1829, when it was illegal in England to worship as a Catholic, with laws in place preventing people from either publicly or privately practicing the faith of the Roman Church, certain songs were written with the express intention of teaching young Catholics the basic tenets of their faith. And some people believe that the 12 days of Christmas is one of these. These believers insist that each of the otherwise, frankly, ludicrous gifts is a coded message representing a significant element of the Catholic catechism. In this case, the partridge in the pear tree is Jesus on the cross. The two turtle doves are the Old and the New Testaments, while the three French hens represent the gifts of the Spirit mentioned in the first book of Corinthians, faith, hope, and love. The four calling birds are, in fact, the evangelists, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the writers of the Gospels. And the five gold rings become the Jewish Torah, the first five books of the Bible, which contain the laws the Jewish people should live by. It goes on. The six geese a-laying are the 6 days of creation, while the seven swans a-swimming are the seven gifts of the Holy Spirit: wisdom, understanding, counsel, fortitude, knowledge, piety, and the fear of the Lord God. The eight maids a-milking stand in for the eight Beatitudes mentioned by Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. Nine ladies dancing? They're the nine fruits of the Spirit listed in the book of Galatians: love, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. And the ten lords a-leaping are, in fact, the Ten Commandments. The 11 pipers piping are the 11 faithful apostles, so don't include the traitorous Judas. And the 12 drummers drumming are the 12 points of belief expressed in the Apostles' Creed. Only they don't mean that, not any of them, at least according to others. The truth is that there isn't any substantive evidence to either support the Catholic teaching claim or to disprove it. What we do know is that the carol was a part of Christmas traditions in Europe and Scandinavia from as early as the 16th century. The familiar words of the 12 Days of Christmas were also published in London around the year 1780 in a collection of children's rhymes called Mirth Without Mischief. It was included in this context as a memory game with accompanying forfeits for the forgetful. Whatever the origins of the carol, the 12 Days of Christmas is the source of much amusement in that it provides a basis for a suitably festive mathematical brain teaser, that of how many gifts does the young lady, who narrates the carol, receive. The gifts sent by the eager suitor, referred to as my true love, are cumulative. The lucky lady receiving them doesn't just receive a partridge and a pear tree on day one, and then two turtle doves the next. Looking at the lyrics closely, it soon becomes apparent that on day two, his sweetheart receives two turtle doves and another partridge. On the third day of Christmas, she gets the French hens, another pair of turtle doves, and yet another partridge, pear tree, the works. So it goes on. Rather than receiving a total of 78 gifts over the 12 days, the narrator of the carol actually receives 364 individual items, one for each day of the traditional year, minus Christmas Day. Now, people have had some fun with this over the years. Since 1984, PNC Wealth Management, based in the United States, has maintained the Christmas Price Index. This is a pricing chart that plots the current cost of one set of each of the gifts given by the true love of the carol. This has even been used as a more general economic indicator. However, it was also used to calculate the true cost of Christmas. In other words, the total cumulative cost of all the gifts listed, including repetitions. There's a growing trend for people to buy more and more of their Christmas gifts online to save money. However, if the true love of the carol had done that in 2007, he would have actually been even worse off. The true cost of Christmas purchased over the internet would have set him back $128,886.
Let's take our final trip down memory lane as Scott Arthur tells us of Christmas memories of the 1960s.
The 1960s, the holly jolly Christmas. It was the decade when everything changed, or so they said. The Cold War pushed nerves to the breaking point. Youth ran wild, and just about everything else went into a blender and came out confetti. a Beatles Christmas album? Who saw that coming? Not to mention the fact that chartreuse trees with purple decorations were suddenly the height of chic. Yet, beneath the funky gift wrap and day-glow tinsel, Christmas was much the same as it has always been. Thank goodness.
Winter time, Christmas time. The time of sugar plums, Santa Claus, and at last those lovable children from Peanuts. Enjoy a Charlie Brown Christmas. Be here as your favorite comic strip comes to life. This year, enjoy a Charlie Brown Christmas.
For youngsters and those who preferred to stay home, TV throughout the 1960s offered a profusion of Christmas fare. Every drama and sitcom did a special show for the holidays. And beyond this, there were specials. While there was a notable absence of memorable Christmas movies during the decade, television specials, for once, mostly lived up to their name. During the 1960s, the team of Rankin and Bass produced a series of stop animation features, which included Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, back about 64, and The Little Drummer Boy in 1968. Popular as the shows were, they were eclipsed by two mega hits that arrived in the middle of the decade. Charles M. Schulz's A Charlie Brown Christmas originally aired in December of 1965, and it became an instant hit. In Charlie Brown's wish to nourish a homely little tree until it shone with the true meaning of Christmas, and the characters' ultimate acceptance of each other's foibles, Americans saw values they feared were slipping away. Much the same could be said of the other classic of the era, Dr. Seuss's 1966 How the Grinch Stole Christmas, which debuted the following year. Narrated by Boris Karloff, the story told of how one mean green Grinch was foiled when the powerless citizens of Whoville united to proclaim their belief in the goodness of the holiday. Like Charlie Brown's little tree, the Grinch was transformed by ordinary love and goodwill, values very basic to most Americans. Over the decades, Christmases have come in good times and bad, in times of prosperity as well as times of want. And they've come wrapped in swirls of excitement and sometimes in clouds of worry and bittersweet longing. But through it all, beneath the glitter and the tinsel, Christmas has remained what it always was, a time to celebrate the joys of the world with the people we love most.
We hope you enjoyed the 2009 Turning Sight into Sound Christmas Special. Thank you to all the volunteers who took the time to be a part of our annual Christmas special. These wonderful stories you heard were from two books, Christmas Miscellany, Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Christmas by Jonathan Green, and Christmas Memories, Gifts, Activities, Fads, and Fancies, 1920s through the 1960s by Susan Wagner. Thank you to Sandy Havens, Jim Seitz, Pearl Hewitt, David Gilmore, and Scott Arthur. I'm Laura Upton. Your executive producer was Jim Martinez. On behalf of all the staff and volunteers at Taping for the Blind, I would like to wish all of you a very Merry Christmas.